It's Doug Fabrizio, and I just wanted to mention before we get started with the show today, which is a conversation with the writer Michael Lewis, that we recorded the interview before the terrible news last week that his 19-year-old daughter was killed in a car accident. After his book about how the Trump administration handled risk, the writer Michael Lewis figured something was bound to happen. The book was called The Fifth Risk, and in it he explored how the federal government just wasn't listening to the experts about the threats facing the country, facing any country, really. Nuclear weapons, financial panics, natural disasters. Now, he didn't predict the coronavirus outbreak, not exactly, but he did see something like it coming. If you know his work, Michael Lewis often focuses on outliers and misfits to dissect the lessons of a larger issue. He wrote books like Moneyball and The Big Short that all had brilliant but eccentric characters at the heart of the story. And the same is true in his latest book. And one of those characters is Charity Dean.
I'd had a number of different people say to me, "You've got to meet this woman, Charity Dean, the assistant deputy health officer of the state of California, but who'd spent most of her career as a local public health officer fighting disease on the ground." I found her at her house in Sacramento, and she had told me a couple of things. One of the things she did that was very important to her was at the end of every year on her birthday, December 20th, she sat down and wrote in her journal her resolutions, and that she transferred these to the back of a photograph of her grandmother, who had died not long ago. So I had that tucked away in the back of my mind while I was looking around her house. She had this thing going on where one form or another, signs kind of hanging to remind her of who she was. And most of these signs had to do with bravery, like to remind her that she had to be brave to do her job well. So at some point I said, "Look, the walls of your house have a lot to say about who you are. And I've only seen the living room and the dining room. Could I just have an hour to wander around and look at everything and poke around your house?" And she said, "Yeah." And she went out back with her kids and I started walking around the house. And I get to the bedroom, and next to her bed is hanging this photograph of her grandmother that she'd mentioned. And because I had permission, I pulled it off the wall and I turned it over and put it on her bed and started to read. And there were all her resolutions going back like 13 years, many of them quite personal, until you got to 2019. And in 2019, resolution number one was something quite personal. Resolution number two, it just said, "It has started." And hair stood up on the back of my neck. And so I went down and I said, "Wait, come up here. What has started?" And she said, "I had this feeling as I was writing my resolutions of this tsunami, this tidal wave coming over the country. And I didn't know what it was, but in fighting communicable disease, I've had to learn to trust my instincts. And I developed a sixth sense. So I always respect the feeling when I have the feeling. And I had that feeling and I wrote it down." Now, this was written on December the 20th, 2019, when no one had any idea that there was like a virus in Wuhan.
What does that say about the characteristic that you identify in some of these characters, this idea of intuition? What does that tell you about? Not that it's spiritual or supernatural, but there's some gift there, it seems.
For me, the mind rebelled at the idea of someone knowing but not knowing how they knew. However, I think that happens. I think people know and don't know how they know. If your business or your life is devoted to fighting disease on the ground, to stopping measles outbreaks or tuberculosis outbreaks, or trying to figure out where some outbreak of hepatitis C has originated, you were constantly in the position of trying to sniff out disease. And I think that if you work those muscles a lot, when you have a sense, a feeling that you can't quite put your finger on why you have it, you learn to respect the feeling. And, you know, looking back on it, you could point to things that might have triggered that sense. But at the time, you had to be consumed with the possibility of disease risk to be alive to those things.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are a few things here Michael Lewis is interested in. First, just what is it about people like Charity Dean that makes them good at seeing bad stuff coming? It's their tenacity and their powers of observation, their quirks that makes them really great players in his books. In fact, the new book is called The Premonition. But he's also interested in why it is that people in charge, or the institutions, I guess, in charge, aren't listening to those experts. It's inertia or arrogance or indifference. And Lewis says it was during the writing process of this new book where he had found these great characters that it became clear this wasn't just about Donald Trump's failings as a leader. This was about the whole system, the whole process of how risks and threats are processed.
If you'd asked me 3 years ago what this book would look like, it would have had Trump front and center. It would have been about a pathology of the federal government in this situation. And that's not what it ended up being. And I had to change my mind and reshift my focus, because what it ended up being was what the characters led me to, was the problems are much deeper than a single administration. We have allowed these institutions to corrode to the point where anybody in the White House was going to have trouble with this thing. And in some cases, we never really built the instrument that would have sufficed to, you know, contain a virus the way they have in Australia, say. And so the characters all end up showing me, and then they end up showing the reader, that if you happen to be someone who, say, despises Donald Trump and is thinking, oh, this whole thing, you know, 500,000 American lives, you can lay that at the Trump's doorstep. If you think that, your mind is coming to rest before it should, and that you actually aren't going to get to the place you need to think as a citizen, how you really need to think if we're going to fix the problem.
You know, it's interesting the way you, the approach that you took to writing this book seems different from what you've done in the past. One of the ways you've described it is you said, I decided to write the people. In other words, I guess what you're saying is you had an idea of where you wanted to go, but you trusted the characters that you found to just lead you. And that seems like a new approach for you.
It is. It's newish. It's true. I was less insistent to know the story and less insistent to have any kind of argument. And what had happened, it was funny. It's just a coincidence. I had stumbled before the pandemic on my next book. And my next book, I'm not going to tell you what it is because I'm going to come back to it. But very broadly, it was a college football coach who was a character of such dimension that I thought, I don't know what's going to happen in his life or in his career or in his season. I don't know what the story is, but I trust this character as a literary event to such a degree, I'm just going to let it go. I'm going to go and whatever happens, happens. And so I had that, you know, I was primed. I had that in my mind as a way to go about writing a book. And I was really excited about going about the book that way. And then this happens. And I didn't actually think, oh, I'll just take that approach and apply it to this book. What happened was three of the very best characters I have ever had in my career kind of land in my lap in a matter of about 3 or 4 weeks. And they're interrelated and they're looking at this event from a different angle. And when you add all the angles up, you kind of get a full portrait of the event. And so I thought, I'll just do that. I'm going to trust the characters. But there was another wrinkle to it in that, you know, I have a hard time even trusting the characters if I don't know where I'm ending. Like, where does this story going to, I got to navigate towards a point. Yeah. And the character, but the characters gave me that right away, because by about June of last year, they'd all more or less acknowledged that what they could have done is no longer possible to do And the thing is, on this pandemic is now on a kind of on a railroad track, and it's going to go. They could tell you how many deaths they were going to be by Memorial Day of next year, kind of thing. And so it was that their ability to intervene was over by about June of last year, and they had in their minds the thought that this isn't the real catastrophe. The real catastrophe is the next pandemic that is lethal in children or more lethal generally. So when I realized that that's where they were in their heads, I knew that was what I was navigating to. It's like, what are we going to figure out from this one to prevent the next one?
You've called this the richest narrative you've ever had. And I have to say that seems amazing because it's hard to imagine you seeing it as richer than what you found in Moneyball or in The Blind Side or in The Big Short. I mean, just taken separately, you know, for a writer, those are once in a lifetime storylines. But you're saying this is among the richest that you've found.
I think, you know, you got to be careful when you talk to a writer who's on a book tour.
Yeah.
Right. Just be careful because you're in a certain weird state of mind about your book. It's a bit like talking to someone about a really great first date. Like they're in love, like they've never been in love, but
you're infatuated right now.
Yeah, but I am, but that's true. But I'm also going on the response of people who've been with me during the journey from the beginning. My editor at W.W. Norton, Star Lawrence, has edited every book of mine, starting with The Liar's Poker. And I think if you said to them, so Michael's got to enter a competition in 20 years, and one of his books needs to be put forward as an example of what kind of writer he was, and you want to put him in the best light, which book do you pick? I think they pick this one.
Wow. Why? Because we're all experiencing it in some ways?
I think it's a combination of the magnitude of the event.
Yeah.
And the novelty of the narrative. I don't want to give myself too much credit. I this isn't false modesty. I'm all for false modesty, but this is the truth. That I am only as good as my material. And it's a bit like when you're playing tennis. And if you're playing tennis against someone who's much, much better than you, all of a sudden you find yourself much, much better. That the material is on the other side of the net from me. And I've had a really good material on the other side of the net for me before, but I have Roger Federer in this case. And it's the material is not just the magnitude of the event. It's the dimensions of these three characters and their interaction with the event. And they're just really extraordinary characters, like literary characters. Like if I were an extraordinarily gifted novelist, I might just be able to make up half of them. But it's just that life generated around, and maybe it's because of the nature of the problem, right? It really is the existential threat. A disease wipes out humanity, and that attracts a certain kind of person to that problem. And to actually kind of devote your life to that problem, you're going to be a peculiar character. So I think that's partly it too.
So I want to talk about some of the main characters, but I want to ask about Bob Glass, Joe, first. Because I think Bob Glass, there's this story associated with Bob. I'm not sure how much you want to say about this. Bob is the scientist back in 2004. He's a scientist at Sandia National Laboratories in New Mexico. And I don't know, talking about the idea of intuition and seeing something, there's this great story associated with him and his daughter and her science fair project. Mm-hmm. Do you mind talking about that?
No, but you're going to have to give me 5 minutes because it's a really good story. So, so Bob Glass is kind of an all-purpose scientist. Funny, he regards all sciences as the same. I'm not quite sure if whether he's a physicist or a chemist or however he's trained, but he's a scientist with a very practical bent at Sandia National Labs, where a lot of big brains gather to solve problems no one else can solve. And he has this funny relationship with his children, his two daughters, that reminded me a lot of my relationship with my two daughters. Only the subject for me is softball. Like I'm obsessed with my girls' softball careers. I'm a little league dad. His obsession is science fairs. He's a science. He's a science dad the way I'm a little league dad. And so the girls, as they're growing up, have this kind of semi-obligation to play, to go to enter the science fairs. And they're happy to do it because they love this interaction with their dad. But he's clearly like in the background. And so they're always looking for what the science fair project's going to be. So Laura Glass, Bob's daughter, wanders up behind her father, and this is 2003, 2004. She's 14 years old, and she sees on his computer screen the manifestation of some software he's written, a program he's written. And the program, but all you see on the screen is lots of dots. All the dots are green but one, and one of the dots is red. And they're moving according to, you know, rules that he has programmed. And when the red dot bounces into a green dot, the green dot turns red until, you know, eventually there's been enough collisions that they're all red. And he says, she's kind of like, what's this for? And he says, well, you know how like one person becomes angry on a street and then other people become angry and all of a sudden you have a mob, or how there might be panic in the financial market. Someone panics and then someone else panics and all of a sudden you have a crash. He says, this is a program that does that kind of analysis. And she said, basically, she said, that's funny because I was thinking disease. We're studying the plague in school. And it looked to me like people were giving, the dots were giving each other a virus. And they said, that's the science fair project. So they start down this road where she does an unbelievable amount of research in how people in their community interact, like how many social interactions they have, how close physically they are to each other when they have them, when they have them. And he builds all these rules into the dots. And he's essentially modeling how, well, in the beginning, she thinks she's studying bubonic plague. But as they progress year after year to higher levels of science fair, they make it more realistic, and it's the flu. And this program, it's not just Bob after a while. He ropes in a man he regards as the most ingenious computer programmer he knows at Sandia to help. So this is unfair, right? It's like I'm gonna rope LeBron James into my pickup basketball game. But at some point it gets so serious that Bob and they start to realize that if you do things in this little artificial community, you disrupt the virus from moving. And one of the big things was like closing schools in ways that he never imagined. Yeah. And he thinks, well, this actually has practical consequences. And he goes into the literature, like the epidemiology literature, the history of the great pandemic of 1918, and discovers that no one has such a tool, and no one has, and that more to the point, there's a kind of fatalism about what happens if there's a pandemic that the received wisdom is all you can do is move as fast as possible to develop a vaccine, that there's nothing you can do with social interventions to slow a virus. So he starts to panic, and he says, like, no one's going to know if we have a pandemic. So he starts to call like famous epidemiologists, and they won't return his calls. Yeah. And now this is where it gets really weird. In the Bush White House, a couple of doctors have assembled because Bush is all of a sudden panicked about a fear of pandemic. And in the Bush White House, they are trying to answer the same question that Bob Glass's daughter is trying to answer. What do you do before you get a vaccine? How do you slow disease? And one of the doctors happens to know a man who dated Bob Glass's sister. Now, that sounds like a pretty remote connection, but that man who dated Bob Glass's sister heard from Laura Glass, the daughter, all about her science fair project at some point. And this guy says, you know, Carter, there's this odd model that this guy out in now Albuquerque has built. And so one day Bob Glass wakes up and he's got a call from the White House saying, you need to be here like tomorrow. And they end up using this model to figure out strategies to deal with disease spread. And those strategies end up becoming the official strategy of the United States embedded in the CDC. And the CDC goes and teaches them to everybody else so that in the last year, if you go to Australia and ask, like, how did you contain the virus here? They'll pull out a playbook that kind of starts with this model in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
I have to say, it seemed like a really important insight in the book, and it sort of comes up a few times, that the idea that that went undetected by a lot of government scientists and others, this idea of how a disease moves through social interactions, like it seems so obvious now, but it would just.
Does it? Well, I came at it like you. I hate to accuse you of ignorance, but I came at this from a position of total ignorance. Yeah. I would have thought obvious, right? You separate people.
Yeah.
It was hardened, received wisdom in the public health community that social interventions didn't work. And that received wisdom had come from 1918 because they had said, people looked at it and said, look, everybody kind of tried stuff. They closed saloons, they closed schools, they stopped church, all that. And still the disease spread with like a couple of weird exceptions, like Gunnison, Colorado actually walled itself off and it worked. But, the received wisdom was you're going to have all these costs and you're not going to get any benefits. Now with the dudes in the White House, these two doctors, Carter Mesher and Richard Hatchett is they go back and look at the record of 1918 and they see that there are actually vast discrepancies from city to city in the mortality. And they say, why? And then they go back in the old newspaper articles, see what the cities did, and also to see when they had the first cases of their virus. And they find that like St. Louis has a fraction of the death rate of Philadelphia because St. Louis instituted these interventions earlier in relation to the arrival of the virus in the city than Philadelphia did. And these guys, I mean, it's kind of an amazing feat that they did this in the White House because these are not academics. This is an oncologist and a critical care doctor who happened to have kind of been pulled into public policy, but basically at heart what they are is doctors. And one of them is kind of at heart a poet. And they are
literal poet.
And they say, and as Richard Hatchett said, he says, here we're sitting here with this, I mean, essentially a revisionist history of a great moment in world history, a completely different view of this event. And who are we? He said we're just a couple of buffoons who wouldn't know how to do a regression analysis if it bit us on the butt. He said so they have to rope in a Harvard epidemiologist named Mark Lipschitz, who's just terrific. I mean, he's like a leader in his field and he knows how to do a regressions analysis, and they all know who he is in his community. And this guy is so impressed by what they've done, he joins in. And they write a paper, and it's like that publication is like one of the most read things ever published in one of these obscure academic papers. But they revise in our understanding of an event in order to help make the argument that this stuff works. And part of that revision was the use of this model developed as a science fair project. So you asked me why I think my book has risen to a level that maybe I haven't reached before as a writer. It's for reasons like this, that I've got this material that it's incredible material.
Michael Lewis, his latest book is The Premonition, A Pandemic Story. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
I'm Scott Simon. What's that old saying, make lemonade out of lemons? How about making your favorite shows out of your old lemon? I know, it's a stretch, but you can donate your car to support this station. Here's how.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, the writer Michael Lewis is with us talking about his latest book called The Premonition. And it's like some of his other books, like The Big Short or Moneyball, which tells the story of something big through the experts who see things differently and see the disaster coming. The disaster in this latest book is the COVID-19 pandemic, of course, and in it he profiles the public health officials and the doctors who are trying to get the people in charge to pay attention. It's interesting how I don't know, I kind of identified as a theme in the book, the idea of bravery, being brave, which kind of brings us back to Charity Dean, this great character. It's interesting you compared her experience to Tara Westover's, just in terms of trying to explain who she is. And talk a little bit about how, because I don't think it's natural to Charity. She has to come to bravery, and it's part of the telling of her story. And there's this, I don't know how much you want to give away, but there's this great story about garden shears. Can you at least talk a little bit about it? Because this idea of bravery is, I think, really important to the story.
The idea of bravery is right at the center of the story. And it's, and we start with how a person becomes brave. And I think Charity is like, if you want to learn how to be brave, you learn about Charity Dean and how she became brave. She grows up in a rural evangelical community that is hostile to the idea of girls getting an education. And in fact, all the pressure she felt, and she in a very poor family, all the pressure she felt was just to be a mom and not she was told not to go to college. She gets a scholarship to go to college, irritates the church elders, further irritates them by going to medical school afterwards because she's obsessed with microbiology and with viruses and communicable disease. She feels like in order to do this, she has to make a deal where she marries a young man who the church has basically picked out for her. The young man at some point in her studies, which is at Tulane down in New Orleans, complains that he's not being paid enough attention to and that she's working too hard. She's number one in her class. And the church elders tell her she has to come home. If she finishes better than the middle of her class, she has to come home. And I mean, talk about the opposite of the right signal. And all this time, she's actually terrified of the church. Scared to death of the church and scared of being kicked out of the only community she knows. And she actually makes a decision that I'm going to let that happen. She leaves the husband. She gets kicked out of the church. She pursues her ambition. But she doesn't do it because she's fearless. She's actually terrified all along. It's like a white knuckle ride for her. And this white knuckle ride gets kind of bumpier when she becomes a local public health officer and all of a sudden is put in this very strange position of not only hunting for disease so she can save lives, but fighting against all kinds of political and social forces greater than her, because, you know, if you shut down the medical clinic that is infecting people with hepatitis C, and because it's got dirty needles and unsafe practices, and that doctor is rich and influential, you got a war on your hands. Mm-hmm. And she finds that over and over, when she gets a big public event, like an outbreak of meningitis on a college campus, the people who might help her, like at the CDC especially, are afraid to do the things that need to be done to stop the disease because they're controversial. And so they leave her out on a limb over and over and over. And what struck me was how she handled being out on a limb. And she said she adopted as her mantra as a local health officer, "No one is coming to save me." There were two things she just kind of accepted almost fatalistically. One was, if I do my job well, sooner or later, I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to be fired. I'm playing essentially Russian roulette. And sooner or later, I'm going to make a mistake because I've got to make judgments under conditions of uncertainty. And one of those mistakes is going to kill me. And the second thing is, literally, in fighting disease, I just have to accept I might get the disease. I'm too close to it over and over and over again. And she, in fact, had almost died of malaria in Africa when she was young, and treating patients in Africa. They're both kinds of bravery. But if you walked around her house, you saw all these stickers that said things like, "Courage is a muscle memory." That was the one I liked the best. Courage is a muscle memory. That she was always reminding herself, having to remind herself to be brave. Because if she didn't remind herself, she'd default to cowardice. And cowardice, she was afraid of cowardice. And I thought, it was quite moving to see someone will themselves to have a quality that they felt that was necessary to save other people's lives. It was all interesting to see someone so self-consciously craft their own narrative to the point where the narrative became the character. It's like if you told yourself a story about yourself often enough, it sort of starts to become true. I do this. I do this with a different trait. I do this with luck. I tell myself over and over how lucky I am, and it makes me lucky. Well, she tells herself over and over again how brave she is, and she becomes brave. And so she gets put in situation after situation, and the book opens with one of these situations. It's Christmas. She gets a call from a hospital in northern Santa Barbara County saying a woman has just died of multi-drug resistant tuberculosis in the brain. TB goes everywhere in the body. Like there's TB of the finger. It's bizarre. And the question Charity instantly has is, all right, one, like where did she work? Oh, she worked in an open plan office with 300 other people. Uh-oh. Two, is it in her lungs? Because actually TB in the brain won't infect someone else. The way you infect is by expiring, by having it in your lungs. So it has to be in the lungs to be contagious. And so she asks, is it in the lung? And now to find that out, they have to go get the lung. But the coroner says, I'm not going to go get the lung because it's too dangerous to go get the lung. There's this paper that's been written that a doctor got infected cutting open a dead body with TB in it. And I'm not going to do it. And she says, you don't have a choice. I have the legal authority to do this. And he says, no, you don't. Hangs up. She goes to the sheriff. Christmas, right? She says, Sheriff, I have the authority to do this. The sheriff says, no, you don't. So she goes to the chief, the attorney for the whole county. And he goes, actually, yes, you do have the authority. And she had the authority precisely because of tuberculosis. These laws got written because everybody was so, TB was the leading killer in the United States at the end of the 19th century, that we created power in this position precisely to prevent the spread of that disease. And so with her legal authority, she goes back to the coroner, and the coroner says, all right, you can do it, but you're going to have to come over. You're going to have to be here to do it. So she gets in her car day after Christmas, goes over to the morgue, and she's in t-shirt and blue jeans, and she finds waiting for her seven men, the coroner and some deputies, and all in full-on hazmat suits. She said it was like they were getting ready to walk on the moon. And they've got the body of the young woman on a picnic table, because they refuse to do it inside because it's even more risky that you're going to get it. And on top of it all, in order to cut the young woman open, you really need a bone saw. But the paper that showed the surgeon being infected or the pathologist being infected by a corpse, he had used a bone saw. So the coroner has gone and hid the bone saw, so she doesn't have that. And so she sees that all they have in the way of a tool are garden shears, that the guy has bought a brand new pair of garden shears from Ace Hardware. And he's basically saying to her, if you want that lung, you're going to have to get it yourself while we watch. And those are the garden shears. And I'm not going to finish the story because that would be ruining the book. But that's the kind of thing she faced routinely.
One of the things you mentioned, you've said that the CDC was not set up as a brave institution, for example. And then in the book, you give some historical context for why this is. And I wanted to ask you, it seems that what you're exploring here is how there are these changes in governmental institutions like the CDC that made them more like an academic institution than an organization that could solve a problem in the real world. Like, that seems like a really important problem, that they became more focused on, I don't know, abstract ideas than on the ground solutions. Is that a fair way to put it?
It's kind of a fair way to put it. I think of it this way, that the incentives inside the place changed from being actually controlling disease to writing papers that were celebrated in the academic community about mm-hmm. what had happened. So it's sort of like it went from being an army to being a department of military history. And it went from being really, really good at grappling with disease on the ground, like it eradicated smallpox in the world. It was set up to eradicate malaria in the South, right? And it actually found that there wasn't any, but never mind. But it was set up as a battalion to fight. And it continues to do this in other countries. This is the odd thing. You can find very effective disease control being spearheaded by CDC officers in other countries. In our country, there's been a drift. And the drifts, I think, if you wanted to mark the moments where the drift started to occur, you go back to the 1970s when first, I think they made the very right decision, but it turned out wrong, to vaccinate the American people against what appeared to be a coming swine flu pandemic. And it was a good, it was best judgment of experts, and the pandemic didn't happen, and the vaccine ended up killing a few people, and it that was the first moment of big controversy for the CDC, and it ended with the director having to resign. And not long after that, during the Reagan administration, the job of CDC director ceases to be a civil service job and becomes a politically appointed job. And that has some really big effects. And this is a story that's not just peculiar to the CDC. It describes what's happened in the American government, that from the early 60s, there's been this rise in the number of presidential political appointees who are effectively sent to manage the various federal institutions. So we have now 4,000 and something of them. The difference between a presidential appointee and a career civil servant is, one, the appointee can be fired on a whim. And whereas the civil servant has to be fired for cause and has recourse to, like, a referee to decide whether this is justified. Two, the appointee is only going to be there as long, usually, as the person who appointed him. And the average tenure of those positions now is like 18 months to 2 years. So you have a kind of a built-in sort of short-term management outlook in the person, as opposed to someone who might be there 10 or 15 years. So it's like, it's a bit like, are you want to leave the house in the hands of a renter or a homeowner? Who's going to take better long-term care of the house? Mm-hmm. And then third, and this is not trivial, is the person who is picked out of essentially out of the pool of people who are politically acceptable to ideologically acceptable to whoever's in the White House. Mm-hmm. And that just shrinks the pool, right? It means that you're not picking from the big pool of American talent. You're picking from a smaller pool of people who are kind of politically connected. And it's just hard to believe you're going to get the best person for the job all the time that way.
Yeah.
So I think the combination of things leads to leadership that is more politicized. And if the leadership's more politicized, then the institution is more politically sensitive. So all of a sudden, you don't want to engage in controversy. You don't want your name in the newspaper, God forbid. Government employees are already like wired for risk aversion. You just amplify the risk aversion.
Michael Lewis. His book is The Premonition, A Pandemic Story. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's Community Calendar is an online resource where you'll find events and services all across Utah. Art exhibits, support groups, scavenger hunts, and more. Whether you're looking to make friends, learn a new skill, or take the family out for the weekend, you're sure to find an activity that you will enjoy. Plus, you can share your own events, too. Just fill out the form. You can learn more on our website at KUER.org/calendar.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer Michael Lewis. We're talking about his latest book, The Premonition. I don't know how much you want to say about where Charity Dean ends up. I don't want to give too much away, but the question does come up about whether it's the government's role or it's the private sector's role. One of the things that she says to you, Charity, is that government has a role, but its role is to empower the grassroots by giving them data.
So she would go further than that. She would say, and to lead, and to explain and to lead. But she was dealing with the political reality of California by the end of March last year, when already we lost the ability to contain it. So the question was how we were going to mitigate it. Containment means just like what Australia did. There's basically no virus that you know, and you guard against it well enough that when it pops up, you squash it, and you can go about your life normally. You can have rock concerts. The mitigation is it's running around the community, but you're when it really flares up, you're clamping down. And anyway, in the reality of that we had in the end of March last year, her view was the only way we're going to get this thing back in the box is if we have buy-in at the local level everywhere. We've sort of lost the ability to lead nationally or abdicated it or decide we're not going to do it. So how do you do that? And she said, here's a list of degrees of virus in your community, just how much transmission there is in your community. And here's a list of interventions that are required given a level of disease transmission. Here, a local community, you're in charge of whether you're open or closed. You control the virus. And her view was that, yeah, there'll be some places that think the virus is a hoax. There'll be other places that are quite vigilant. And the vigilant places will experience these happy outcomes because they'll squash the virus and it'll open up. And the less vigilant places will find themselves overrun by the virus and they'll have to implement these restrictions. And she thought, or hope, it was hope because you just don't know. She thought it was the only hope, was that if you did it at the level of the community, like the neighborhood, like you organized neighborhood by neighborhood, that people would put pressure on each other to behave, that people wouldn't move around as if they had the right to infect other people with a deadly disease, and that there'd be social pressure to modify your behavior to keep your neighbors safe. And that was her plan because she thought that was the best shot we had.
I have to say, though, she also says that she didn't believe that the American government at this moment in history would ever do what needed doing. And I wondered about, one of the things you mentioned is that there was no money in it.
Yeah.
She needed to find a way to make it pay. And that seems like a depressing lesson.
It is a depressing lesson. And she and I don't completely agree on this. I tell her story, but I'll give you her view and then I'll give you my view. We're not that far apart, but we're a little bit far apart. She's earned her view and I haven't. So I would take my view with a grain of salt. But her view was, here she is. All she wants to do in life is be a public servant. All she wants to do is stop people from giving other people deadly diseases. Mm-hmm. And she's willing to take a third the pay she should make in private practice to do the job. She has virtually no material ambition. She's not a money person. And she's enormously talented and resourceful. And yet even in that situation, she's unable to actually do the government won't let her do the things she can do uniquely. And she's kind of, she's squeezed out of where she belongs. And she looks around the society and she says, well, who does let people take risk? Where is funding available? Where is the energy to take on big problems? And she says, it's in the private sector. And I'm not a business person, but I'm going to create a company. It's going to be called the Public Health Company. And it is going to be it's going to find a way to do something that the government has been able to sell. And that is, it's going to make prevention pay. That it's going to be able to, I don't know, go to a cruise ship company and say, if you have our seal of approval, people are going to be more likely to get on your boats because they're going to know your boats are safer. Or it's going to go to some manufacturing company and say, if you want your supply chain not to be crashed by COVID outbreaks in some factory, you'll hire us to make sure these factories are actually designed so people don't get sick in them. And it takes her, minutes, minutes before people are pouring millions of dollars of venture capital onto her, before the smartest people in Silicon Valley want to go work for her. It's just like incredible, the resources that just instantly organize around her in the private sector for what should be a public sector function. And
explain though, Michael, when these people are confused when she says she has a company that she wants to save the world and protect our country. That was her first spin, right?
This was very funny. This is kind of funny because her first ambition is quite grandiose. She says, I'm going to build the company that saves the country for the next one. So that we have the tools to fight a pandemic. But when she goes, and says that to venture capitalists, they're not that interested. I mean, they're interested, but it's just like, what's the business, right? And so she has to refine the pitch so it sounds like a business. But her secret ambition is still to build this enterprise that will save the country. So she is secretly building an enterprise to save us from ourselves by masquerading as a for-profit company that will probably have lots of for-profits. But it's an odd way to go about it. And when the rubber hits the road, and it comes to, we have a variant of this virus, or we have another virus, or we just want to reform our institutions and have something like what Charity created at the center of some institution, the government's going to have to be involved. You're going to require the government for local health officers to mobilize. Mm-hmm. She's, as a private company, she's not going to be able to lead the public sector. So at some point, there's going to have to be some conversation between the thing Charity is creating and whoever happens to be running the administration. It's not yet.
Yeah. So Charity's feeling doubtful right now. You say she's going to need the public sector, of course, but she's just feeling like, I'm not sure we can really innovate there. I'm just wondering what your point of view is, in the sense that, because it doesn't seem like you feel like the public sector is so irretrievably broken that we can't find a way to deal with these things.
So I don't feel that way. I feel like we're Americans. We can change our society and we can change our government. I do feel that way. But the Charity's never hopeless. She's never hopeless. If you ask her about this pandemic, she will say, somewhat oddly, Mother Nature just gave us a gift, because this could have been so much worse, and it will be so much worse if we don't prepare ourselves. And Mother Nature showed us the weaknesses in our society and our vulnerabilities, and now we have a chance. We have a chance to look at ourselves in the mirror and fix it. And so where I differ from Charity is, I think I've not given up on the government's ability to reform itself. And I think there are things we could do, like change the structure of the institutions, so you have more permanent leadership, long-term leadership in them, like making it easier to hire and fire people, like create incentives for people to take risks rather than to hide, it isn't just the CDC. We need to look at these institutions and say, we don't want them big. The point isn't big. The point is like wildly effective. Like we want the most effective government. And you don't get that by running it the way we're running it. No private company could succeed being structured the way the federal government's structured. We need to rethink that structure. And I think it's at least possible that this scare we've just had is a catalyst for the rethinking. I know it's messy. I know you can't just walk into Washington and change things. I know they're obstructionists, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think it's impossible. I just don't.
You've called this a superhero story with a twist, I
guess. Yeah, it does have a twist. And the twist is that the superheroes lose. It reminded me, the feeling I had is trite, but it's true. The feeling I had about this story as I was writing it, it felt a little bit like that Avengers movie where at the end, they're not dead, but they're all beaten up. And like the villain, the bad guy seems to be about to rule the world. And you think that was it. they didn't win. And then you realize it's sort of like this was an opportunity for them to regather and figure out how to go back at the villain. But the structure was that it was like these people, these three characters I've written about, they have these superpowers. They were doing their damnedest inside of a broken system to try to save us from ourselves. Their deeds, their actions, in a funny way, draw a sketch of all the problems in the system for us. They reveal the problems in the system. Now we need to follow their lead and fix the system.
Michael Lewis, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was totally fun.
Michael Lewis, his latest book is The Premonition, A Pandemic Story. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.